and welcome to Worlds Apart. Just a year ago, the pronouncements about Western unity solidified by shared liberal values on the inside and aggressive barbarism on the outside seemed ubiquitous and straightforward, but it's hard to look at them with a straight face anymore. Putting aside its supposedly unbreakable unity, will the West itself, as a political, economic, military, and ideological bloc, survive the year of 2026? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Philip Hammond, an emeritus professor of media and communications at London South Bank University. Professor Hammond, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Now, in my introduction, I referred to the West as a self-evident entity, but historically speaking, it's a relatively recent geopolitical concept born out of the Cold War, when sticking together meant, practically a survival. It had an existential meaning. What does it stand for in the absence of the Cold War?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think that it's a question that Western politicians have been grappling with really since 1989. There was, of course, a moment of triumphalism at the end of the Cold War, but quite quickly, commentators started to see the problem that if you don't have something to define yourself against, then the onus is on you to decide to define what it is you stand for. And that was a question that they've continued to find very difficult to answer. In the 90s and early 2000s, early years of this millennium, there have been various answers, and probably the most successful ones revolve around issues of values, Western values, although actually articulating those values has proved very difficult. And as you say, there's been a kind of recourse to just defining what you're not, so that the democracy versus authoritarianism, and exactly what that means, exactly what those values are, has always remained somewhat vague.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say in another interview that after the end of the Cold War, the West was left with no vision, no forward-looking project for where society is heading. And I personally find it such a nihilistic sentiment, because it presupposes that ordinary life itself, with its incremental challenges and incremental developments, has no intrinsic meaning, that you have to somehow augment it by some glorious challenge or vision or even adversity in order for it to be worthwhile. Do you think Western societies, or at least Western elites, can exist without, an enemy?
In terms of, Western elites and what they started to call in the 90s enemy deprivation syndrome after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think that there are obvious political benefits for those elites in having an enemy to kind of rally against. But even, as I was saying a moment ago, even in that moment of post-Cold War triumphalism, think of, for example, there was immediately a kind of worry about, well, so what's next? So think of, for example, Francis Fukuyama and his famous end of history thesis. He even said, the end of history is going to be very sad. It's going to be very boring. It's going to be, all we're going to have is kind of those mundane, everyday problems. There's going to be no sense of a grand mission or a kind of horizon of meaning to cohere societies around. And you might think quite reasonably, well, sort of, so what? Can't we just get on with our with our lives? Why do we need that? But from the point of view of Western elites, I think that is a problem, because they suddenly found that the ground on which they had built a kind of claim to legitimacy had kind of crumbled away. So what do you put in its place? How do you shore up that sense of legitimacy and purpose and a kind of moral superiority?
Well, I have one idea. I mean, I would think that what's supposed to happen organically is that after the period of the Cold War, people would for a while disengaged from the public life, or at least from the sort of existential anxieties that it carried. They would invest more energies into the immediate circle, into their families, into their, you know, interests, into their communities. And that would produce a new sense of purpose, you know, grounded, connected to reality sense of purpose that could be fed back into the public life and that would organically drive the transformation of public policy and, you know, give politicians new tasks. I heard you say that this is something that politicians in the West are very concerned about people, ordinary people disengaging from public life. Why would that be?
I think that that was a problem in the, particularly in the 90s, they started to talk about what they called the democratic deficit. The fact that people were disengaging and you know, sort of focusing on immediate personal problems. And the issue is that, you know, you have to remember that there was a kind of well-established framework for domestic political contestation in Western societies, a framework of left versus right. And all of a sudden, that's gone. That's. I mean, people still use those words, of course, frame issues in those terms, but it's kind of lost the substance. It's lost the meaning that it once had. And so, if you're a Western politician or a leader in those circumstances, you somehow kind of find it difficult to engage with your own citizenry. That's the kind of issue that they identified and grappled with in the 90s. I have to say that in more recent years, they've now got kind of the opposite problem, that people are, as far as they're concerned, engaging a bit too much with politics. You know, since the kind of populist revolt, now the worry is more similar to the worries of Western elites in the early 20th century, around the kind of 1920s. Teens and 20s, people like Walter Lippmann were saying, how do we manage the public? How do we control this kind of public mass engagement with politics? That's now the contemporary problem. And you could also, by the way, say that there is, of course, an international dimension to this, that I remember that, you know, that kind of positive gloss that you put on it. I remember that very well from the immediate aftermath of the Cold War. They were talking about a peace dividend. Wouldn't it be great? You know, all that money we used to spend on armaments and so on, now we can spend that on more constructive things and benefit our own societies. That lasted about 5 minutes. And then, of course, they were engaging in military operations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there and everywhere.
Now, speaking about this immediate aftermath of the Cold War and this search for new meaning, you said that it was Ronald Reagan's idea of humanitarian imperialism that seemed like an inspiring solution for a little while. From what you know, were there ever any reservations to this kind of policy at that time? Not only about the prohibitive costs, I suppose, but also, you know, the sheer skepticism about, you know, remaking the whole world in your image.
Well, first of all, to say I'm not sure it was Ronald Reagan's own personal idea. I think it was more accurate to say that he, you know, was one of the people that articulated it, and he was an important kind of spokesperson for that idea, in the sense that on the day that he was giving a speech laying out this new post-Cold War mission for the United States and its allies, his former vice president and successor, George Bush, the first George Bush, was putting it into practice already in Somalia. And in fact, they'd already done that a little bit in the aftermath of the 91 Iraq war with the Kurdish crisis. In terms of criticism, well, you know, there are always a few critics, but by and large, most of the criticism throughout the early post-Cold War years tended to be that the West wasn't doing enough. You know, and that's indeed, I think that indeed contributed to the development of the doctrine of what Tony Blair called the doctrine of international community, the idea that the West has this kind of right, duty, responsibility to go around policing the world. And obviously there's an element of self-interest in that, but by and large, the criticism was was that the West was not taking enough of a burden in intervening elsewhere.
Now, however they were framing it at the time, I think it's pretty clear that running this kind of policy is prohibitively expensive, and it doesn't really deliver any bang for the buck, to use the American expression. Are you surprised that it took almost 30 years for it to start falling apart, as we have been seeing over the last couple of years with domestic procurements, domestic infrastructure disintegrating, and the funds diminishing for, you know, the very basic necessities of life?
I don't think that's true what you say, but I don't think that's what's driving it. I don't think it's a question of suddenly finding, oh, look, we've got this enormous bill that we've got to pay. I think that they always regarded it, the costs of it, as worth it. And you've got to also remember that in the American context, the defense industry is like a kind of enormous government subsidy to various sectors of industry, not just those engaged directly in producing weapons, but there's a kind of massive state investment in the American economy via the defense budget. I think more what's driving it is the relative decline of American power and the relative rise of other sources of power, most particularly China, but also Russia.
But in addition to the change in the international balance of power, there is a clearly deterioration of living standards, at least in the United States. That's a big part of Donald Trump's campaign, both for term one and term two. And I wonder, if it wasn't for Donald Trump, do you think there would ever come a point where the Americans would get exhausted by putting so much money into not only this kind of policy, but also into NATO, into Europe, especially as they see the rise of formidable competitors in Asia?
Well, I don't think, you know, if you put yourself in the position of a American leader or elite politician, I don't think you're just going to give up and say, oh, well, I'm tired and the bill's too big, I'm going to stop.
But isn't that what Trump was saying? He's saying exactly that.
Well, you know, on the one hand, some of the things that he has said sound a bit like that, but you can see yourself that he it's not as if he is backing down from international activism. It reminds me a little bit of the kind of thing that Trump said when he was running for his second term. It reminds me a little bit, actually, of what Bill Clinton was saying in the early 90s. Bill Clinton's slogan was "Come Home, America." Mm-hmm. We're going to, you know, all this international activism, that's just too much of a burden. We don't want to do that. We want to focus on our own domestic problems. Well, when those problems start to look too difficult, too intractable, too hard to solve, there is a kind of temptation to then look to the international sphere as a place where you can demonstrate a quick and authoritative sense of purpose and doing, show yourself doing something. But I also think that Bill Clinton's presidency then turned into one of enormous international activism, and Trump similarly. But I also think that there is a kind of, with Trump, there is a very kind of direct self-interest. There's a kind of, it looks to me anyway, like there is a kind of, there's a new set of problems, and as I mentioned a minute ago, an emerging new multipolar world, and America, I think, realizes it's got to kind of fight for its interests in that and counter its rivals. And I think that's part of the purpose behind what the kind of things that Trump's been doing.
Okay, well, Professor Hammond, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
See, you're washing the Moscow mules. And we're gonna brainwash the crap out of you.
Getting word from Red Square.
Who are you? I don't care what my voters say.
I am not a warmonger. I am a peacemaker.
Eating the dogs, eating the cats.
Huggy, there you go. All squeaky clean.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Philip Hammond, an emeritus professor of media and communications at London South Bank University. Professor Hammond, before the break, you were talking about the use of foreign policy by the West as a diversion tactic, and primarily by the Americans. But I still think that the way Trump is doing that is very different from the previous administrations, because his engagements are very limited in scope, you know, dropping a couple of bombs. But for now, no regime change in Venezuela or in some other countries where he has involved himself. And he's also made it clear that he wants to divest resources, not only from NATO, but also from Europe, in order to, you know, spend more time, more resources in Asia. Do you think that means any difference for the transatlantic relationship, particularly for the European Union? Because many political scientists believe that the Europe's chief objective at this point of time is to keep the Americans in and keep them spending money and providing guidance and direction for them.
I think that the Europeans indeed are extremely worried by Trump. First of all, to address your initial point, that I think that's correct, that Trump, so far at least, it's been more the kind of demonstrative, sending a signal, showing what American power looks like kind of interventions, rather than, you know, those kind of prolonged quagmire-style interventions that have occurred in the past. We'll see how that develops. But for the Europeans, I think that this is a tremendously worrying moment, and you could kind of see in the reaction, certainly of British politicians, when they were asked by journalists about what Trump's just done in Venezuela, kidnapping Nicolas Maduro, that they were saying, well, you know, can you say that this is illegal? This is against international law, and British politicians responded in an extremely kind of cringy way, as it were. They wouldn't condemn it. They kept saying, "Well, we should wait and see. You don't want to offer a running commentary." But of course, I support international law. So, or the rules based order, as they refer to it. I think what from the Europeans' point of view, there's a kind of intense nostalgia for that pre-Trump era, where the Americans offered a kind of ideological umbrella, a political umbrella that gave them a sense of meaning and purpose too, that they were part of this shared project.
Mm-hmm. Professor Hammond, I think it's not only political or ideological umbrella that was so soothing, but they also received a lot of resources out of the Americans, you know, free security, also, you know, a lot of economic benefits, and all of that seems to be slipping away. And you're right that they're trying to manage Trump in the way they can, essentially trying to sit on the two stools, you know, not aggravating him too much, but also keep a little bit of sort of moral covering. And for a while, they've been successful. But what about Greenland? Because I think with Greenland, Trump is pushing into the territory where you cannot really play that appeasement game anymore.
Yes, he is. I mean, Greenland, I think Trump's plans for Greenland, I think, seems very kind of almost eccentric. It's very kind of left field. It took a lot of people by surprise. But in fact, there is a kind of history to it. The United States, for years, going back even to the 19th century, has from time to time staked claims on Greenland. They kind of agreed at the end of the First World War that America would get what was then the Danish West Indies, now the Virgin Islands, and Denmark could have Greenland. That's a kind of very 19th century, I mean, it happened in the 20th century, but it's a very old-fashioned attitude to the sovereignty of smaller states. And I think we're seeing a return to that now. During the kind of post-Second World War era, the UN system was based, at least politically, on the norms of sovereign equality and non-interference in other countries. That was actually destroyed in the post-Cold War era, and in the process of changing from the UN system to what they now call the rules-based order, which is written roughshod and explicitly indeed rejected the idea of sovereign equality and non-interference. So the people who are now going on about international law and the rules-based order are the very ones who in fact destroyed the post-war UN system. And so Trump is kind of following through the logic of that in his claims to Greenland.
You described Trump as eccentric, but I think there's also a strategic thinking behind his escapades, because it is pretty clear that the United States does need to pivot to Asia, and pivoting to also means pivoting away. You need to get some resources for investing in Asia and contending with China and perhaps other rivals. And some Russian scholars have indicated that, you know, this Greenland initiative may be seen in through this prism as well, because Greenland is not only a gateway to the Arctic to, you know, projecting power, but it's also, you know, a seat of enormous mineral resources that the American economy needs to be on par with China, India, and many others. Do you think there is an economic motivation in all of this?
Yes, I do. I mean, I said that it seems eccentric. I think that it's, you know, it's been understood as just a kind of oddity of Trump's personality or something. But as I said, there is a long history of this. And The designs on rare earth minerals and so on, I think that's a more recent a potential benefit that's become more recently visible. But yes, the security and strategic concerns are long-standing, in fact. And control of the Arctic is one thing, but also, you know, again, kind of sending a message to and heading off potential gains by rivals such as Russia and China, which Trump very explicitly says, you know, that's what he wants to do.
Yeah. And I think that if it were just about military power projection into the Arctic, the U.S. would have no need to change Greenland's territorial or national affiliation, which only come to matter when you deal with property rights or maritime boundaries. Do you think Denmark or the EU more generally are ready to give away such a luxurious piece of geopolitical real estate?
Well, they've said that they're not. I mean, if you looked at it kind of rationally, you could say, well, why didn't America? America already has and has had since the end of the Second World War a military presence. Why not just increase the military presence if that's your key concern? Perhaps you could say, well, now there's the added desire for control of mineral rights and so on. But maybe they could have even negotiated that without such kind of aggressive stance. It sometimes looks as if Trump is almost goes out of his way to kind of take an aggressive posture towards Europeans and tell them, in effect, that, you know, you have to understand there's a new reality here. We're not here to serve you or to help you or to, you know, take you under our wing in the way that we might have done in the past. We are looking out for our own interests. And Europeans, I think, have, you know, they're entirely kind of confused by that and don't know how to respond to that. Whether, if push comes to shove, whether Denmark and other European countries would stand up to the United States in that regard, well, it's hard to say, but at the moment, it looks extremely unlikely. It looks more like that they would, you know, what are they going to do? They don't have any resources really to do that.
Well, and many of their military resources are shipped to Ukraine. But speaking about the European reaction, yeah. The Prime Minister of Denmark said publicly that an American takeover of Greenland would mean the end of NATO. Wouldn't that be the best of both worlds for the Trump administration, disinvesting himself from NATO and all the expenses and acquiring such a great asset?
It might be. I mean, obviously, Trump has said many negative things about NATO. On the other hand, there are some also benefits in having, military allies, even if America is always...
But wouldn't he have them anyway without having to invest in them?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So if you could push the Europeans to spend more money buying arms from the United States, preferably, and arming themselves, and you can subordinate those allies to even more subservient position to U.S. power, then that would be a win from Trump's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Now, we keep hearing from Western pundits that Vladimir Putin is celebrating watching all these developments from the Kremlin. And to some extent, I wonder if that's true, because when Putin and Trump met in Anchorage last year, one potential area of cooperation that was discussed was the cooperation in the Arctic. And the Russians, for now at least, have the largest ice-breaking fleet in the world. I don't think they would have any problem, dealing with Trump rather than dealing with this European cohort that which doesn't really know what it wants, except for prolonging the war in Ukraine. But looking into the future, do you see any potential problems from this kind of development, both for the United States and for Russia? Could it bring the return of the Cold War if the two nations were left one-to-one in the Arctic?
Possibly. I mean, every now and then it does look a bit like a new kind of Cold War is developing, not just between the US and Russia, but also between the US and China. But I think that implies a kind of stability that we're quite a long way from seeing. I think I'm more expecting prolonged instability. I think you're also right to imply that the role that the Europeans play is a destabilizing one. The Ukraine was an excellent example of that, where at least it looks on the surface, I mean, who knows really what goes on underneath, but it looks on the surface as if Trump was hoping to strike a deal, end the war. Probably U.S. interests have to be served in whatever deal came out of it. And that the Europeans are really kind of spoiling for a fight and wanting to prolong it. That's certainly the case. So, how far the West, if we can still use that as a meaningful concept, how far they are willing to kind of engage in kind of pragmatic, mutually beneficial arrangements, I think is open to question.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Hammond, I'm afraid we will have to leave it there without a conclusive forecast for the future. But thank you very much for being with us today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.